Sam downstairs, I say, as I put him in his cot. I picked up a few things for supper. Can you pop the groceries in the kitchen? Hayden hasn't moved. I smell cigarette smoke. He promised not to do that. I begin putting groceries away, sorting out the cold items for the fridge, opening cupboards, Hayden staring at me from the doorway. Something's wrong. Your mother phoned, he says. I don't respond. When did she go back to Spain? I'm not sure, I say, continuing to unpack. Hayden picks up a can of tomatoes and seems to weigh it in his fist. She was pretty fucking surprised when I mentioned Rory. Do you know what she said? I don't answer. She said, "Who's Rory?" And I said, "Your grandson." And she laughed like I was joking. "But you were at the birth," I said. And she laughed again. Still I say nothing. Hayden slams the can of tomatoes down on the counter, which sounds like a gunshot in the small kitchen. He holds it up again. I hear Rory start to cry. I can explain. Okay. First, tell me what you told her. I told her about Rory. I said you had him in Leeds, a home birth. Is any of that true?
Yes.
Who was with you?
A midwife.
I fill the electric kettle. Do you want a cup of tea? Fuck the tea. Why did you lie to me? I don't get on with my mother. I knew she'd try to take control. She belittles me. She bosses me around. She manages to poison everything good in my life. Why go to Leeds? You could have stayed in London and had the baby. I could have been there. I got scared.
Scared of what?
I've never told you this before, but Nikki and I lost a baby. I was 5 months pregnant. She died inside me. I was terrified it might happen again. That's why I didn't want you there. I didn't want anyone with me, not friends or family.
Hayden doesn't seem to know how to react. He wants to believe me. I can see that. But his faith has been shaken. He asks about the miscarriage. He wants the details. Who, where, what, and why. I find myself telling him the truth. I saw what it did to Nikki, losing a baby. That's why we divorced. The marriage couldn't survive the heartbreak.
Rory's still crying, growing more and more distressed. That's why Nikki contacted me. He heard about me having a baby. He was happy for me, but also a little sad.
Is that why he topped himself? Asks Hayden.
I don't know. Maybe. I move towards the bedroom, wanting to comfort Rory. Hayden grabs me by the wrist, twisting it painfully.
Why lie to your mother?
I didn't lie to her. I just didn't tell her. It's none of her business.
Why do you hate her so much?
She wouldn't understand.
Try me.
She's crazy, manipulative, cunning. She has 1,000 cliches in her head, and when she opens her mouth, it's like they're all trying to escape. I bet she said she loved me.
Hayden nods.
Did she say I broke her heart?
Yeah.
Was she drunk?
She sounded sober.
She's very good at hiding it. I peel Hayden's fingers away from my wrist. He hasn't finished.
What else have you lied about?
Nothing.
You lied to Jules, to me, to my family. It's not right. You made me feel like an idiot.
I'm sorry.
I put my head against his chest. He pushes me away, holding me at arm's length.
Your mother didn't even know about me.
Because I don't talk to her.
Hayden doesn't answer. Stepping around him, I fetch Rory from the bedroom, jiggling him in my arms until he stops crying. Hayden hasn't given up.
I want to know the name of the midwife, the one who delivered the baby.
Why?
I want to talk to her.
What can she tell you?
The truth.
I'm telling the truth. Why would I lie about her?
Call her. He knows. He knows.
I pick up my handbag and take out my mobile, flicking through the contacts list. Hayden waits.
I can't find it.
You don't have her number?
I do. I'm trying to think. My phone was dead, remember? I have her number written down somewhere.
What about paperwork? There must be something.
Of course, lots of paperwork, I say, getting flustered. I can't remember where I put it.
He knows. He knows.
So you have no phone number and no paperwork.
This is bollocks. He grabs his jacket.
Where are you going?
I'm taking Rory for a walk.
No!
I say it too urgently. I mean, where?
Maybe we'll go to the zoo. He's never been to the zoo. Can I come?
No.
Why?
I don't want to see you for a while.
I make up a bottle for Rory and help Hayden get him ready. I'm still reaching for excuses, not wanting them to go. I tell him that I'm desperately in love with him and that I've never seen a father as wonderful as he is and that I couldn't do this without him. I say that I would marry him tomorrow at Fulham Registry Office and I would go anywhere in the world with him as long as we were together.
Hayden says nothing. He's not listening to promises or platitudes. He doesn't love me anymore.
Don't tell anyone, I say, pleading with him. Tell anyone what? I mean, don't tell your parents about my mother. They might not understand.
You're right, he replies.
I don't understand. You tell me lies and you don't do anything to help us. What does that mean?
You could have sold your story to the papers, the one about knowing baby Ben's mum. We could have made some money.
I don't want to talk to reporters.
Mrs. Shaughnessy's doing plenty of talking. She's always on the news, crying for the cameras. I'm sick of hearing her voice.
Don't say that.
Why?
You don't know her.
I know her type. Perfect hair, perfect teeth, perfect marriage, and now the perfect sob story. She gives me the shits.
Hayden used to feel sorry for Meg, but now he's attacking her because he's angry with me or testing me. I have to show him I can be honest. I have to win back his trust.
They're not perfect, I whisper. You said that before, but what does it mean?
Jack Shaughnessy had an affair.
How do you know?
I saw him with another woman. He was buying condoms at the supermarket. She was parked outside. He jumped in her car. They were kissing.
Who was she?
An estate agent. She sold them their house.
Hayden whistles through his teeth. Dirty bugger.
I shouldn't have told him. I should have kept my mouth shut. Please don't tell anyone, I say. It ended weeks ago.
Hayden doesn't answer. He carries Rory down the stairs and straps him in the pram, tilting it backwards as he lowers it down each step to the street. I watch them from the front window, resting my forehead against the glass, following their progress until they reach the corner and disappear. I want to go after them. I want to snatch Rory back. I know that Hayden wants to believe me because he loves our little boy, but I'm giving him too many reasons to doubt. He hasn't accused me of faking my pregnancy and stealing a baby. But has it crossed his mind?
No.
He doesn't think I'm clever enough to do something like that. But from now on, he's going to watch me more closely and check up on everything I've said and done. Even if I forge the paperwork for the birth, I can't conjure a midwife out of thin air.
Why couldn't my mother leave me alone?
Megan. The police arrived before 6 a.m. in a convoy of cars blocking the street outside. Doors open in unison, and officers march past the reporters and cameramen. Jack answers the doorbell, still in his pajamas. DCS McAteer hands him a search warrant.
Who is it?
I ask from the top of the stairs. Officers are moving past Jack. They're dressed in overalls and wearing latex gloves.
We have authority to search this property, McAteer announces, no longer sounding avuncular or sympathetic. I will allow you to stay here so long as you don't interfere. Police personnel will accompany you while you get dressed. I suggest you then assemble in the kitchen.
What about the children?
Them too.
Jack keeps asking what's happened. Do they have information? Is there some reason why they're here? He looks at me, hoping for an explanation. I shake my head. Lisa Jane accompanies me to the bedroom and watches me dress. I move towards the bathroom. She follows.
Can't I do that alone?
She shakes her head.
Why are you here?
She doesn't answer. For the next 2 hours, we sit in the kitchen as police search everywhere from the attic to the cupboard below the stairs. Our computers and iPads are confiscated. We're told we'll get them back once the hard drives have been copied. Belongings are picked up, opened and examined. Books are feathered. Furniture is moved, and carpets are peeled back to reveal bare floors. I wonder what they imagine they might find. Hidden rooms? Secret stashes? This is crazy. Our questions are ignored. Officers are polite, but adamant that we don't interfere. First names are no longer used. Jack is incensed.
What have we done? Where is the justification? They're trying to deflect attention. They can't find Ben, so now they're going to blame us. That's ridiculous. Why would they think that? I don't know. But look at what they're doing.
He confronts McAteer, demanding an explanation, refusing to be fobbed off. The detective unbuttons his suit jacket and pushes his hand into his pocket.
We have received information.
What information?
Someone called the hotline.
Who? What did they say?
On the night Ben went missing, you left the hospital before the police arrived.
I was looking for Ben.
You were missing for almost 2 hours.
I knew what the nurse looked like. I thought she might be nearby. I've told you this already.
Did you come back here?
What? No.
You were seen carrying something from the house that night.
That's ridiculous. Whoever told you that is lying.
By leaving the scene, you compromised the investigation. You weren't able to give us a detailed description. There could have been fibers on your clothes, DNA trace material.
I didn't think.
Where did you go?
I told you.
I'm looking at Jack, as though I'm part of the interrogation, suddenly wanting the same answers. Jack meets my gaze, his eyes pleading with me, no longer angry. Instead, I see another emotion. Fear.
Do we need a lawyer? He asks.
That's completely up to you, Mr. Shaughnessy.
DCS McAteer turns to me.
I wish to speak to you in private.
I want to tell him that Jack and I have no secrets from each other, but that's not true. Not since I slept with Simon. Not after this. Leaving Jack with the children, I follow the detective to the sitting room. He closes the door. I notice signs of the search. Officers have tried to put everything back in place, but it's not the same. The photographs on the mantelpiece are in the wrong order, and the DVDs are mixed up. It's like a robbery where nothing has been taken except my peace of mind. McAteer motions to the sofa. I choose to remain standing. The room feels too small for the both of us.
I'm going to ask you several questions, he says. I would appreciate you answering them truthfully.
When have I not been truthful? I say, trying to sound annoyed.
Did your husband want this baby?
I hesitate a moment too long.
Don't treat me like an idiot, Mrs. Shaughnessy. I have men and women working around the clock on this case. Thousands of hours of overtime, resources, expertise. Answer the question.
He wasn't happy at first, but he came round, I say.
Has he ever hurt you or your children?
Never.
Your daughter was taken to hospital at the age of 2 with a cut above her eye.
She tripped over Jack's legs and hit her head against the window seat.
Does he view online pornography?
No, never. I mean, I don't think so.
We're going to search his computer. We're going to search yours as well.
I have nothing to hide. Even as I utter the statement, I realize how trite it sounds, like a line from a crappy movie. A great actress could deliver a line of dialogue like that, but I'm not a great actress, and I'm a worse liar. McAteer is getting to the point.
2 days ago, you left the house at 10 o'clock at night.
I went for a walk.
Why?
I needed some time alone.
Where did you go?
Nowhere in particular.
How did you get out of the house?
I waver, wondering how much he knows. I climbed over the back fence and walked along a railway line.
You crawled through undergrowth.
I didn't crawl.
You've recently had a baby. You're supposed to be resting. Yet you snuck out of the house, climbed a wall, and illegally trespassed on a railway line.
I didn't sneak. I would have gone out the front door, but in case you haven't noticed, there are reporters outside.
McAteer isn't buying any of this. You had a visitor when you came home from hospital. Simon Kidd.
Who is he? An old family friend. He was best man at our wedding and is also Lucy's godfather. He works with Jack.
You were upset afterwards.
It was nothing.
You told PC Lisa Jane Sousa that Simon Kidd was trying to blackmail you.
It was a misunderstanding.
McAteer gives me a fierce, tight-lipped smile. Mrs. Shaughnessy, have you, or anyone close to you, been contacted privately by any third party claiming to have your baby?
No.
because if you have been contacted and you were considering paying a ransom to a blackmailer, you would be breaking the law.
I understand. I promise you, we haven't been contacted by anyone.
An odd feeling of relief floods through me. I'm going to get away with this.
McAteer picks up his hat and walks to the door. He has one hand on the doorknob.
Just one more thing. Is Ben your husband's baby?
I beg your pardon.
Is he Jack's?
There's a momentary pause, a gap in time that might only last a heartbeat, but it feels much longer.
How dare you suggest? I love my husband.
My anger sounds forced and absurdly formal.
That's an outrageous thing to say.
McAteer nods, but doesn't apologize. He places his hat upon his head and tilts the brim as a tiny gesture of farewell.
Take care, Mrs. Shaughnessy. The value of a secret depends upon whom you're trying to keep it from. You may think it's worth a lot. I may think it's worthless. Someone always has to pay.
Agatha. I always knew there was a risk that my mother would find out about Rory. I hoped it would be months from now, when people had forgotten details of his birth and he was fully established in my life. Now she keeps phoning and leaving messages, asking when she can come and see her grandson. I've ignored every call, letting them go to voicemail, but I can't keep fobbing her off. I punch out her number and listen to the ringtone. She picks up.
Agatha? I've been sitting here, hoping you'd call.
Her voice has a quivering frailty, which I don't remember. An affectation, maybe, trying to gain sympathy.
A baby, she says excitedly. I couldn't believe it when Jaden told me.
Hayden, I say.
Oh, sorry, Hayden, yes.
We're engaged.
That's wonderful. I'm happy for you. How is Rory?
Fine.
Is he a good baby?
Yes.
Are you breastfeeding him? They say it's the best thing. I know I didn't breastfeed you, but we didn't know as much about breastfeeding back then.
And you wanted to keep your figure? I mutter.
What's that, dear?
Nothing. Why did you call me?
A mother doesn't need a reason to call her daughter.
How did you get my number?
I called your old temp agency.
So what do you want?
I want to come and visit, to see my grandson.
No.
Please, Aggie, don't be cruel. I know I made mistakes. I know I wasn't always there for you. But I've said I'm sorry, and those things happened a long time ago.
Why did you call me yesterday?
What?
You spoke to Hayden. You must have had a reason to call.
Yes, I did. It was about Nicky. It was in the papers. I get them delivered from London. A story, only a few paragraphs, saying he fell under a train. You did know, didn't you? About Nicky, I mean.
Yes.
I wasn't sure. They think it might be suicide.
There is a pause.
I always liked Nicky, she says.
You barely knew him.
He used to call me every week when you were married.
Liar.
He did. I promise. Even after your divorce, he sent Christmas letters and would telephone on my birthday, which is more than you ever did.
He didn't know you like I did. She ignores the comment.
Poor Nicky. Such a nice man. It must be horrible for his poor wife.
I don't respond.
You and Nicky were really good together. It's a shame you couldn't have children. I know you tried.
Another silence, this one painfully long.
How did you manage to get pregnant?
She asks. Normal way.
Nicky always said, I mean, I thought.
She doesn't finish the statement. The pauses are making her stutter.
Well, if that's all, I say, preparing to hang up.
But you haven't said.
Said what?
When I can come and see Rory.
Never.
Please, Aggie.
Her voice is breaking.
I have no one else. I want to be a grandmother. I want to make amends.
It's too late.
Don't be cruel.
I listen to her hiccuping sobs and try to hang up, but the phone is still in my hand.
When are you back in Leeds?
I ask.
At the end of March.
Maybe you can see him then. Megan. The police are here again today. This time they're scouring the trees and bushes behind the garden wall, next to the railway tracks, because I told them about the hiding place I discovered when I snuck out to visit Simon. Initially, DCS McAteer dismissed the idea of someone watching the house, but Cyrus Haven convinced him to take it seriously. Now forensic technicians in white overalls are hammering stakes into the damp earth to set up a grid. I can hear Jack coming before he reaches the kitchen. Ever since the police searched the house and seized his computer, he's gone quiet. At first, he railed against their incompetence, accusing them of trying to shift the blame or covering their asses. At the same time, he's trying to figure out which of our neighbours called the police and claimed to have seen him carrying something out of the house on the night Ben was taken. His suspicions have settled on the Pringles, who live two doors away and have a teenage son who was arrested for vandalism last year after Jack caught him damaging cars in the street. I'm standing at the French doors, watching the technicians at work beyond the garden. Jack appears at my shoulder.
Did the police ask you about Simon?
Yes.
Why do you think they wanted to know so much about him? Surely he can't be a suspect.
I don't know. Jack pauses and chews at the inside of his cheek.
The other night, when I was arrested, you went to see Simon.
It is not a question.
Yes. Why?
I was worried about you.
Me?
You'd just been arrested. You accosted some poor woman. You were drunk. I thought you were losing it.
Why visit Simon?
You told me that you'd been to see him earlier that day, and he made some reference to me.
Jack presses his thumb against his wrist, as though taking his pulse.
He lifts it and watches the white, thumb-shaped outline slowly turn pink. I feel him framing another question.
Why did you climb the back wall?
Because of the reporters.
You could have called Simon.
I wanted to see him face to face.
Jack looks past me into the garden.
Some of the technicians are on their hands and knees, scraping, sampling and dusting, putting food wrappers and soft drink cans into plastic bags.
At least you've given them something to do, he says.
The front doorbell chimes. I answer it. Our local priest, Father George, has come to visit. Since the kidnapping, he has dropped around every few days, sitting in the front room, drinking tea and offering me sympathy and a shoulder to cry upon. I haven't used the shoulder, but I appreciate the sentiments. Jack makes an excuse and flees, leaving me to handle our spiritual well-being. Father George is in his 60s, with one of those deep, sonorous voices that you normally hear on motivational tapes or late-night radio. His visits are beginning to irritate me, because he treats me like I'm Lucy's age and I've lost a pet, rather than my baby. At the same time, I feel guilty every time I see him. When we set our hearts on sending Lucy to St. Osmond's Catholic Primary School, we knew it wouldn't be easy. There were usually 90 applications for only 30 positions in the reception class. Part of the application was a declaration from the parish priest saying that Lucy had been baptized and that we attended church regularly. For 6 months, we trooped off to Mass every Sunday, making sure to say hello to Father George as he greeted people at the doors. It seemed quite exotic for a while, dabbling in the religiosity of it all, the supernatural and otherworldliness, to pray and praise and give thanks. Of course, once Father George signed the form and Lucy was accepted, our weekly visits to Mass began to dwindle to token appearances at Easter and Christmas. I apologized to Father George for having used him. He laughed.
You didn't use me.
We tricked you.
As did most of the other parents.
Is that frustrating? He smiled wryly.
They're good people with busy lives. I'm sure that one day they'll return to the fold, just as you will.
Father George and the parish council have organized a candlelight vigil for tomorrow evening, which I've insisted be non-denominational. I haven't agreed to attend, but I know it's expected. As if reading my thoughts, Father George reaches across from his armchair and clasps my hands.
We want you to know that you're not alone. We're all praying, you know. I dare say the whole country.
Not everyone, I reply, anger flushing into my eyes. The person who took Ben isn't praying for his safe return. He smiles serenely, unshaken by my animosity, which makes me want to rage. What sort of God does this? What sort of God creates a world where there's so much misery and injustice and pain? I say nothing. Father George opens his Bible.
Would you like to pray with me now?
I'm not very good at praying.
I can start.
I sit quietly as he makes the sign of the cross and conducts a one-sided conversation with God, asking him for strength and guidance and love on my behalf.
Help Megan not to blame herself or those close to her, he says, and help her never to give up hope. You know what it's like to lose a son. You sent Jesus down to earth, and he paid the ultimate price for our sins. Please, help Megan overcome this test with your love and guidance. Help her heart to heal.
After Father George has gone, I discover that he's left the Bible on the coffee table. Pages have been marked with red ribbons. Opening to one of the passages, I read a few lines about God healing the brokenhearted and binding up their wounds, but I see nothing about finding missing children. Saint Anthony is the patron saint of lost things. Does that include children? Probably. There's a saint for most things, sailors, scholars, brides and prostitutes. There's even a patron saint of drug dealers, Jesus Malverde. I saw that once on an episode of Breaking Bad. Agatha. Rory vomited both feeds last night. I had to change his sheets twice and dress him in clean clothes. This morning I weighed him again, and there's been no change in the past week. I know bathroom scales aren't very accurate, but I don't need a machine to tell me that he's sickly and struggling. There are no gassy smiles or happy sighs, yet when he looks at me with his enormous eyes, he seems to be saying, "Please, Mummy, don't give up on me. I'll get better." He's asleep now, lying next to Hayden on the bed. Turning on the TV with muted sound, I catch a glimpse of a reporter standing beside a railway line. The camera pans to the left and zooms between trees to reveal a familiar-looking house. Then, it pulls back to show men and women in white overalls searching the undergrowth and shrubbery beside the tracks. I press the volume button. Forensic teams have been out since early this morning, searching the back garden and surrounds, taking away samples and measuring footprints. Police aren't saying exactly what they're looking for, but through those trees and over that wall is the house belonging to Jack and Megan Shaughnessy, the parents of baby Ben. I recognize my fallen tree, my clearing, my hiding place. What could I have left behind? There were some soft drink cans and chocolate wrappers. A few times I peed when I couldn't hold my bladder any longer. They don't have my fingerprints on file or my DNA.
You were seen. Nobody saw me. What about the neighbors?
I was careful.
They'll trace your phone.
There are hundreds of phones passing that place every day. I turn off the TV and tell myself to relax. I have to stay calm and look after Rory. He needs all of my focus if I'm to make him healthy and strong. It helps to stay busy. Two bags of rubbish need to go out. Hayden should have done it last night. I carry them to the ground floor and down the front steps, turning towards the bins. Two people step from a car. One of them is a woman, squeezed into high-waisted slacks and a matching navy jacket. The man is younger, but pretending to be world-weary and experienced.
"Is your name Agatha?"
the woman asks in a neutral way, neither friendly nor hostile. I nod, aware of the door behind me.
"We detectives investigating the disappearance of Ben Shaughnessy."
A voice fills my head, telling me to drop the rubbish and run, lock the doors. We were hoping we could have a word.
Do they have a warrant?
What's this about? I believe you were acquainted with Megan Shaughnessy. We're friends.
Ask for the warrant.
I force myself to move, carrying the bags to the bins and putting them inside. I wipe my hands on my jeans. Have you found baby Ben? I ask. Not yet. Poor Meg, I say, brushing a strand of hair from my eyes. She must be devastated. I sent her a message, but it's hard to know what to say.
You've just had a baby yourself, says the man.
That's right.
It's cold out here. Maybe you could invite us inside.
I don't really want to wake the baby.
We'll be very quiet.
I lead them up to the flat where I've left the door propped open. Can I get you a cup of tea or coffee? I only have instant. We're fine, says the woman detective, who gives me her card. I study it for a moment, buying time, reading her name out loud. Detective Sergeant Alison Maguire. And this is Detective Constable Paulson, she says, studying the array of best wishes cards on the mantelpiece. You had a boy?
Yes.
What's his name?
Rory.
The woman has thick eyebrows and olive skin, and might possibly look attractive if she let her hair down and smiled more. She takes a seat. Hayden chooses that moment to make an appearance. He's wearing only boxer shorts, scratching at the dark strip of hair beneath his navel. He blinks at the detectives, but doesn't act surprised. Crossing to the kitchen, he turns on the tap and fills a large glass of water, drinking it too quickly so that droplets fall onto his chest. He wipes his mouth.
We're investigating the disappearance of baby Ben, explains DC Paulson.
Hayden sits on the edge of my armchair. Beads of water are clinging to his chest hair. You might want to put some clothes on, says the DS.
Last I checked, this was my gaff, replies Hayden.
She nods, as though accepting his ground rules. Your wife was telling us about your new baby.
We're not married.
I see.
Hayden doesn't seem to like the fact that she's a woman.
We're engaged, I say. Are you Rory's father?
Yeah,
replies Hayden. DC Paulson has taken out a notebook, pencil poised.
When was your baby born? He asks.
Almost 3 weeks ago. I give him the exact date.
Where did you have him?
In Leeds. That's where I'm from. My mother lives there. I'm volunteering too much information. I should wait for their questions. DC Maguire toys with a loose thread on the cuff of her jacket. A man would tear or bite it off. A woman will wait for scissors. I've spent some time up north, she says. What hospital did you choose? I had a home birth. I wanted familiar surroundings. A trick question, deflected easily, but now she's unsure how to follow up. Hayden has put his hand on my shoulder, as though offering support. Were you present at the birth? She asks him.
No, I just missed it, Hayden explains. I'm Royal Navy. I flew in from Joburg. Arrived a day too late.
I went into labour early, I say. So who was with you for the birth?
A midwife, I say, trying to sound calm.
And your mother, adds Hayden, lying for me.
Why would he do that? I emailed photographs to Megan, I say. She was so excited for me. Now I feel guilty.
Guilty?
Given what happened. There I was, celebrating and feeling so clever. And 2 days later, Meg had her baby stolen.
You couldn't have known, says Hayden.
I know, but still.
Do you have photographs of the birth? Asks DC Paulson.
Of course. I pick up my phone and scroll through the pictures until I find the ones that I took upstairs in Leo's bedroom. I didn't take many. My mother isn't much of a photographer. I hand him the phone. He passes it to his colleague. How long have you known Mrs. Shaughnessy? Asks DS Maguire. Not that long. We do yoga together. I used to see her when I worked at the supermarket in Barnes. She gave me some baby clothes. Again, I'm talking too much. The detective glances slowly around the room, as though noting the general shabbiness and cheapness of my furniture. When did you see her last?
A few weeks ago, before I went up to Leeds.
You knew she was having her baby on December 7th?
Yes, she told me. Have you met her husband, Jack?
No, I've seen him on TV. He's a sports reporter.
Stop talking, Agatha.
D.S. Maguire returns my phone.
When you were at yoga classes, did you notice anyone hanging around or asking questions? Someone who might have taken a special interest in the fact that Mrs. Shaughnessy was pregnant?
Special interest?
More than usual.
I think about this. Begin a sentence. Stop. Shake my head.
What is it? Asks D.C. Paulson.
It's probably nothing, I say.
Let us decide.
Well, there was this one woman. Meg and I were having coffee in Barnes. As I was leaving, she came up to me and asked me where I was having my baby.
Did she talk to Mrs. Shaughnessy?
I'm not sure.
What did this woman look like?
My height, dark hair, heavy set, but not fat, I say, pausing to concentrate. She looked like she just had her hair done, maybe at one of the local hairdressers.
How do you know that?
You can tell when it's been cut and blow-dried.
How old was she?
Late 30s or early 40s?
Was she pregnant?
Not obviously. I guess her clothes were baggy.
A pencil scratches on the page.
Why does it matter whether she was pregnant? I ask.
We think whoever took Ben might have faked a pregnancy to hide their crime.
Really?
You don't sound convinced.
Is that even possible? What about all the scans and tests? Surely somebody would find out.
D.S. Maguire wants to get back to talking about the woman.
Had you ever seen this particular woman before?
No.
She opens a folder and takes out an identikit picture from the hospital.
Could this be her?
It's hard to tell.
The next image is a still photograph from the CCTV cameras at the hospital. I'm being presented with a photograph of myself as a brunette with long hair. The grainy image shows the top of my head. A second image is from behind. That uniform made me look huge.
It could be her, I say. I can't be certain.
There's a squawk from the baby monitor resting on the kitchen bench. Rory's awake. He grumbles and lets out a louder cry.
He's hungry, I say, getting to my feet. I cup my breasts.
I still can't get over how he does that. One little cry and my milk starts flowing. Hayden's gone to get Rory. He emerges from the bedroom, holding him in the folds of a blanket. Rory is wide awake, watching the detectives, neither of whom look particularly paternal or maternal.
You're welcome to stay, I say, but I'm getting my boobs out.
The younger detective wants to be somewhere else. I walk them to the door.
If you see Megs, tell her, I'm thinking of her, and if there's anything I can do to help.
I wait on the landing, watching them leave, listening to the creature.
What if they look for a record of Rory's birth?
What if they call your mother? What if they look for the midwife?
Hayden's sitting on the sofa, jiggling Rory in his arms.
They weren't very friendly.
They were okay.
I don't like cops.
Why?
He shrugs. A lot of them have mini Hitler complexes, you know. They enjoy pushing people around.
I want to ask him why he lied for me, but I'm afraid of the answer.
I'm hoping he's still on my side. Nobody could fake a pregnancy as well as I did. The police should ask Megan. She'll tell them. She doesn't doubt me.
Megan. Lachlan and Lucy have been bathed and dressed in their best clothes, hair washed and brushed, shoes polished. They're under instructions to stay clean while I get ready. I keep changing my mind about whether I want to go to the candlelight vigil, but Jack says we should thank people and acknowledge their support. I have nothing to wear. I don't want to dress in maternity clothes, and I can't fit into most of my pre-pregnancy dresses, apart from one clingy woolen number that makes me look lumpy. Jack is polishing his shoes on the landing. I've told him not to do it there because he'll get boot black on the carpet, but he never listens. I turn back and forth in front of the mirror, not liking anything about myself, but also not caring. I just want to get this over with. Downstairs, I put on my coat and call the others. Lachlan runs down the hallway. His trouser cuffs are too short. I swear I only took them down a few days ago.
I want to put a brick on his head to stop him growing. Lucy looks pretty in a tartan dress with red tights and black patent leather shoes. She has matching red gloves to wear because it's cold outside.
Are you ready?
Asks Jack.
I guess. We can do this.
I try to give him a smile. The security lights trigger as we leave the house and reach the front gate. Two police officers are waiting to escort us to St. Osmond's, which is about half a mile from here. They offered to drive us, but we're going to walk in a kind of candlelight procession, collecting people as we pass. TV cameras and photographers are being kept behind barricades. The bright lights whiten every face and turn every breath into a pale fog. Hooking my arm into Jack's, we each take a child's hand. Neighbours appear, holding lamps, torches, and candles flickering in paper cones. They nod as we pass, and fall into step behind us, as our procession wends its way through the narrow streets, across Barnes Green and along Church Road, where it turns left into Castleknow and heads towards Hammersmith Bridge. Soon it's clear the church isn't big enough. People are standing in the aisles, along the walls, and spilling outside onto the steps. Seats have been reserved for us at the front. Lucy and Lachlan sit between us, both too small for their feet to touch the floor. My parents and Grace are next to me. Jack's brother and sister-in-law have come down from Scotland. Around us, there are mothers, friends, neighbours, workmates, babysitters, and people I'm only on nodding terms with, like the butcher and the Korean woman who does my nails. My yoga teacher has had her baby and looks impossibly thin. The headmistress from Lucy's school is directing people into pews, making sure they make room for more. Two of my oldest friends from university have made the journey from Leicester and Newcastle. A woman with a lovely voice leads a choir, which entreats everyone to lift their hearts to God. Most people move their mouths silently, pretending to sing. After the hymn, Father George gives a nice sermon about those times when God seems absent and how we must hold on to faith or risk falling into fear. He calls on Jack to say a few words. My heart lurches. I had no idea he had planned this. Jack climbs several steps to the lectern, where he pauses and adjusts the microphone, tapping it with his finger, apologizing.
Since Ben was taken, I have asked myself countless times, why? Why him? Why us? There is no answer, but that doesn't stop me searching for one. A child is reported missing every 3 minutes in the UK. Across Europe, that number rises to one child every 2 minutes. In America, it's close to one child every minute. I know figures like this sound shocking, but we only hear a fraction of these cases because most of the children come home or are found quickly. We have all sorts of safeguards. Amber alerts, digital billboards, child rescue organizations, Facebook, Twitter, stranger danger campaigns, CCTV cameras. Yet still, children disappear. Until 2 weeks ago, I thought I understood what it would be like to have a child go missing. I'd watched other parents on TV. I'd put myself in their shoes. I was mistaken. To lose a child is beyond comprehension. It defies biology. It derails common sense. It violates the natural order. Like a lot of people, I sometimes fail to appreciate how lucky I am to have such a wonderful wife and family, a good career, great friends, and, as this evening shows, a very close-knit community. Often I forget to give thanks and take things for granted. Not anymore. To the woman I love, sitting in the front row, I cannot give you what you desire the most, a chance to hold your baby boy. I have seen your selfless devotion to Lucy and Lachlan, and I know how deeply you feel Ben's absence, because there is no loss quite like a mother's loss. On every occasion over the past fortnight, when I have wondered how I can get through this, I have looked at you. Your strength of character, fortitude, and resolve are truly inspirational.
I love you, Megan Shaughnessy. I love you, Lucy and Lachlan. And Ben, wherever you are. I love you too.
That's when I dissolve, collapsing into sobs. The rest of the vigil passes in a blur. I find myself standing and moving through the crowd, thanking people, shaking hands. I notice Agatha. That must be her fiancé, Hayden. He's carrying their baby in a pouch against his chest. I didn't know if I should bring him, Agatha says, unsure of whether to hug me or shake my hand. I kiss her cheeks. I thought it might be insensitive. No, it's okay. This is Hayden. It's nice to meet you, I say. He nods and looks uncomfortable, as though sadness might be infectious. Stepping closer, I look at their baby, whose face is partially hidden in the folds of Hayden's shirt. He's beautiful, I say, struggling to get the words out.
I'm sorry about Ben, says Hayden. I hope they find him.
I don't answer. I'm being moved on. I turn to Agatha. Look after him. She doesn't understand. Your baby, I explain. Never let him go. Agatha. There are reporters, photographers, and cameramen everywhere. Surely there must be bigger stories to report. What about the wars, terror attacks, homegrown jihadists, or drowning refugees? Public attention should have moved on by now. Something newer and fresher should have captured the headlines. Reporters are mingling with the crowd, asking the same questions. How do you feel? Are you shocked? Fearful? What do they expect people to say? Clichéd questions get clichéd answers. Nothing like this has ever happened around here, someone says. What's the world coming to? Says another. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Adds someone else. Wonder what? I want to scream. Wonder why bad things happen to good people. Wonder if we'll be home in time to watch Strictly. Why won't people accept that Ben has gone? Rory is the one who matters. It would be cruel to send him back. The interests of the child must always come first. That's what judges always consider in child custody cases. Rory has a mother. He has a family. Ben doesn't exist anymore. Meg was fine until Jack made that speech, and now her mascara is smeared on her cheeks and she has panda eyes. Lucy and Lachlan look like they're handling it well. People often forget about other siblings in situations like this. It's like what happened to me when Elijah died. I was forgotten, unloved, less important. That's what I want to say to Megs. Love your other children. Focus on them. People linger outside the church, hugging and handing out tissues. Random strangers touch Rory's head and smile, as though reassured that the world goes on. The priest draws a small sign of the cross on Rory's forehead and says a blessing. I turn and almost bump into Meg's. She looks at Rory and I feel a rush of fear. What if she can tell? Some animals can smell their own children or recognize their cries. I don't know if Meg spent long enough with Rory to know these things, but she carried him for 9 months inside her womb. He's beautiful, says Meg. I wasn't sure if I should bring him, I stammer. Of course you should. Is he a good baby? They're all good babies, I reply, before realizing how that sounds. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. She hugs me and looks at Hayden. It's nice to finally meet you. And you, he says. Did you make it home for the birth? Not quite. Well, you're here now. I'm sure they'll find your little boy, says Hayden. Thank you. Meg is ushered away by a police constable who is keeping reporters at bay. Let's go, says Hayden, who seems to share my unease. A photographer steps between us. Without asking, she begins taking pictures of Rory and Hayden. Can we get a shot with you? She asks. We're doing a story on the candlelight vigil. Do you know the Shaughnessys? Yes. Can you lift him out of the sling? That's it. Hold him a little higher, next to your cheek. The flash keeps firing. A recording device is thrust under my chin. Are you frightened for your own baby? Asks a reporter.
No. Why? It's shocking, isn't it? You don't expect babies to be stolen.
No, I guess not.
Do you have a message for the person who took baby Ben?
No, not really. I think everything has been said.
Megan. Morning, 6:15. Red digits glow on the radio clock. My hand slides across the cool sheets, but the bed is empty. Jack must have woken early and decided to get up. We made love last night after the vigil. He didn't penetrate me, my stitches, but we found other ways to get close, and it did more to heal us than a dozen counselling sessions. Yet even as he moved against my hand and lips, I felt Jack slowly running down, like the mainspring of a clock. I pulled his face close to mine and saw the tears. He squeezed his eyes shut, trying to hide them as he moved faster and moaned my name. I doze again. When I wake the second time, I turn on my mobile. There are dozens of messages, questions about a story in the newspaper. I open a link, but the doorbell chimes downstairs. I hear Annie's voice and DCS McAteer's. I jump out of bed and shrug on a dressing gown, pulling my hair into a band. They're in the kitchen, Annie, Jack, and McAteer. Lucy and Lachlan are watching cartoons in the sitting room. Newspapers are spread across the bench. Jack is poring over them, looking shocked and pale. I join them and glance at the pages, noticing a photograph of Jack and me. A second picture shows a glamorous-looking woman with tousled hair, white teeth and a low-cut blouse. I recognize her, the estate agent who sold us the house. The headline screams, "I didn't steal baby Ben," and the one below it, "But I'm in love with his dad." Jack tries to close the pages. I put down my hand and push him away, reading the opening paragraphs. A London estate agent has denied any involvement in the abduction of baby Ben Shaughnessy, but admitted to having an affair with his father, well-known sports presenter Jack Shaughnessy. Rhea Bowden claims she and Jack shook the house down when they had sex in dozens of different properties she was selling in South London. Those houses include the one in Barnes that she sold to Jack and Megan Shaughnessy last December, 3 months before she and Jack began their affair. Jack is trying to force my fingers off the page.
"Please, Megs,"
he says, his voice thick with, what, guilt, shame, remorse? I keep reading. "We bumped into each other at a trivia night at a local pub, the Sun Inn, and Jack offered to buy me a drink. He bought a bottle of champagne," Rhea Bowden told the Daily Mirror. "We flirted and laughed and were both pretty drunk by the second bottle. We finished up kissing in a doorway and making love in my office. I knew he was married, of course, but I didn't realize his wife was pregnant. After that, Jack would call me when he had an afternoon off. We'd either meet at my place or go to one of the houses I was showing. I know it was wrong, but whatever people think or say about me, I didn't take baby Ben. I love Jack. I would never harm his family." The newspaper rips as Jack wrenches it away from beneath my bald fists. My eyes are swimming, but I refuse to cry. I look at the other front pages. They all have the same story, writ large in bold headlines. I picture the entire country sniggering over their cornflakes or muesli, gossiping around the photocopier or over garden fences or at checkouts. We are no longer that poor family who lost a child. We are tabloid fodder. We are a soap opera. Jack hasn't just cheated on me. He has humiliated me. He has made a mockery of our marriage and every statement we've made about being a loving family. We don't deserve sympathy. We don't deserve to get Ben back. I go upstairs. Jack tries to follow. McAteer stops him. He has questions to answer.
"Can't it wait?" asks Jack, pleading with him. "No."
I pull an overnight bag from the cupboard and randomly fill it with clothes. I get dressed. I zip up my boots. I walk downstairs, out the front door, along the path. My keys fall out of my hand. I bend to pick them up. The circus is all around me, the cameras and reporters shouting questions.
"Did you know about the affair?"
someone yells.
"Are you leaving him?" asks another. I can't answer. I lock the car doors and push the ignition, sideswiping a police car and shattering the side mirror as I pull away. I don't care. I'll run them all down. They can lock me up and throw away the key, as long as they leave me alone. Agatha. My little boy is dying. I've known it for days, but have told myself that he'll bounce back and grow stronger. Yes, he's struggling, but all babies feel poorly sometimes. They go off their food or run a temperature or cry for no reason. I have never feared anything for myself, not since I was a child. But I fear for Rory. What if I cannot protect him the way he should have been protected? What if I fail? Last night, I fell asleep next to his Moses basket. Waking, stiff and cold, I reached out and touched Rory's forehead. His tiny body was radiating heat. I wiped him down. I gave him medicine. I waited until he fell asleep, before I shook uncontrollably, knowing it was happening again. I am losing someone I love. He is fading away, disappearing by degrees, ounce by ounce. I come awake. It's light outside. I'm alone in bed. Hayden must have risen earlier and left me sleeping. I go to Rory's bed. His body is so pale and bloodless, I catch my breath. Terrified, I extend my hand and brush my fingers over his chest. His lungs fill, his heart beats. He lives. Just. The fever is still gripping him. I give him paracetamol and wipe him down. I let him hold my finger in his fist as I try to breathe for him, inhaling and exhaling. He's dying. Not yet. He needs a doctor. I can't. Shrugging off my nightdress, I open my wardrobe and notice something different. My clothes have been moved, pushed aside at each end, exposing the rear shelves. The middle one has a blue box made of coated metal with a hinged lid and padlock. It contains a few scant mementos from the past, the bits worth keeping. A second-place prize certificate for handwriting. A spelling trophy, my birth certificate, an out-of-date passport, a handful of wedding photographs, and a strip of photo booth prints showing me at age 16, sitting on the lap of a boy I liked whose name I can't remember. The box is facing the wrong way. I look more closely and notice scratch marks in the paint where the hinges have been unscrewed and reattached. I carry the box to the kitchen where Hayden is eating a bowl of cereal. Have you been going through my stuff? What stuff? My box. Why would I do that? That box is private. Why? It just is. I don't like secrets. It's not secret. It's private. Don't you trust me? You lied about being married, about your mother, about giving your coat to charity. You even lied about your age. He points to the box. I saw your birth certificate. You told me you were 29. You're 38. A woman is allowed to lie about her age, I say, trying to sound light-hearted. Hayden's face is blank. He doesn't find me funny anymore. I called that number you gave me for the midwife. It was a recorded message. She's away until January. That's not my fault. I feel relieved, but don't let it show. It took me a day to think up that plan. Buying a SIM card and pre-recording a message using a voice disguising app. You have called the voicemail of Belinda Wallace of the Yorkshire Home Birth Service. I am out of the office until January 7th. Have a wonderful Christmas and New Year. Hayden hasn't finished. So I called your doctor. I found his name in your phone. But he didn't know you were pregnant. I stopped using him. Jules helped me register with her GP. Right. That explains everything, he says cynically. I pretend he's joking. What is this? The Spanish Inquisition? I'm not sure yet, says Hayden, softening a little. I want to believe you, Aggie, but I'm frightened of what you might have done. And who you've hurt. Standing barefoot on the floorboards, I begin to shake, and I swallow a coppery taste that could be blood.
Every sound is amplified. I hear the soft swish of traffic on the wet road outside, and a District Line train pulling into Putney Bridge Station. I glance